Thanks for tuning in to Happy Horror Time. Before we get started, we're going to play a quick promo for one of our favorite true crime podcasts, The Jury Room, hosted by Kevin Cook. He recently released an episode on The Night Stalker that you'll definitely want to listen to after you finish this recording. We think you'll really enjoy it. So, here we go.
Hi, and welcome to The Jury Room, a true crime podcast. My name is Kevin, and I will be your host on this journey. We will be covering some of the most heinous, some of the most unthinkable, and some of the most monstrous crimes to ever be committed against humanity. We will be covering cannibalistic serial killers, decades-old unsolved mysteries, cold cases, and missing person cases. The Jury Room podcast is available on most major podcasting platforms. Please make sure you leave a review. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Happy Horror Time. My name is Tim Murdoch.
And my name is Matt Emmert. And we have a special episode today, Tim.
Very special.
Almost as special as my cat looking at us with his eyes closed right now.
creepy cat.
So all I got to say is that if little guy is our cat, and if he is bored already, look, I don't know if we are. Now he's looking. So he's into it. How are you doing, Tim? Before we jump into
I'm doing good. My back hurts a little bit because I'm an old man.
That is correct on both counts. I get lower back pain, and I'm sure
mine's a little upper.
You know what? We're old. But anyone who is over, I mean, it's tough being 25 compared to Tim at 43. But
yeah,
like,
that's right. You know, I own my age. I'm not hiding it from nobody.
Good for you. You should, because
44.
No one's pretending you're not.
But I'll be 44. Gifts are optional.
I know. No. Tim's birthday. Well, in a few months, actually.
April.
Oh, God, it'll be your second pandemic birthday.
It's okay.
Because
I'm in good company, because now everyone will have a quarantine birthday.
It's true. One whole year we're coming on. So that means that if your birthday is like at the end of January, February, and you thought I'm getting through this with no quarantine birthdays, you wrong.
Guess again.
But back to why or what makes this episode special. We're doing something a little different. Rather than our usual talking about two horror movies, we are going to talk about a horror-related documentary that Netflix released a couple weeks ago. It's called The Night Stalker, The Hunt for a Serial Killer.
And, you know, it's kind of like two movies because it's two episodes, so it's all the same.
Oh, yeah. It's four two episodes. It's like 4 hour long episodes. So it's basically
it's just a really long movie.
It's a really, really long movie.
It's not a movie. It happened.
Exactly. If you're unfamiliar, it's about the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, who was a famous serial killer that killed many, many people in Los Angeles and San Francisco counties in the 80s. And before we even get into all that, another reason this episode is so special, Tim, is because we have a guest with us to talk about the Night Stalker
documentary.
Someone that
knows a little bit more than we do.
Well, someone, Ed, that is very special to us because he is our co-producer, and he also is the host of his own true crime podcast. So we wanted to welcome to Happy Horror Time, Jacob Randall.
Woo!
Hey, you guys. Thank you.
We are so lucky to have you. I'm so grateful because I don't know anything about the things that you do to make this podcast the number one podcast in the world.
Well, no, for those of you.
And yours too, of course.
Well, the number one, I mean, number two. No. Jacob edits our episodes. He helped us put together the theme music. He makes it so we don't sound all over the place. He edits out when we sound stupid. Actually, whoa,
so that's why I don't get much airtime.
I was gonna say that's why we have 0 to 2 minute episodes. No, yeah. But before we even get into this, just want to set a disclaimer on this. We are not attacking this documentary like a true crime podcast, because we definitely are not that. We don't have the knowledge, we don't have the skill.
No,
we
we're just watching it as viewers. I mean,
entertainment
factor. It's entertainment, but you know, here's the thing, it really happened.
Yes,
it, and you know, definitely. I didn't, it was not left on me. Like, I wasn't like, I felt it.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I want to make sure viewers know that we're not giving a report on the Night Stalker, as probably Jacob would on his podcast.
Right. We're not Tom Brokaw.
He is on top of all that stuff. We are very much just entertainment focused. We do no research.
No, but you know what? I feel a little smarter. I mean, I will. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't have. I've heard. You know what my introduction to the Night Stalker was? It was in Nightmare on Street 4 when she goes, "I'm not going to let some Night Stalker beat me." That's all I knew.
Well, I'm interested, actually, Jacob. What did you know about the Night Stalker before this documentary?
You know, I'd read about the Night Stalker a lot over the years, but it's not one of those cases that I got too far into. And I think it's because, just like, and you guys are from, well, Matt, you're from California, so you know that in the 70s and 80s there were just so many different serial killers operating out of California. The Night Stalker, the Freeway Killer, the doodler in San Francisco that they never caught. And then the list goes on and on and on. And so, like, with the Night Stalker, I never quite got into all of the details, because for one thing, it's just so incredibly violent, and the crimes are, they're filled with such anger, and they're just so crazy. And every crime scene is like this tornado, like a tornado hit it or something. And so for some reason, just the whole, all of the details and the mess around it, and then I guess the fact that I knew that that he had been caught and eventually he died, there wasn't a lot of mystery left in my mind about it. So, you know, my podcast is mostly unsolved stuff. So that was kind of the reason I wasn't really drawn to it.
Well, I can tell you, before we get into the actual documentary, my real life experience related to the Night Stalker, ooh, because it is kind of scary. Not that I ever, I met the Night Stalker. We went on a date once.
You never
no.
talk about it.
No. In the summer of 1985, I was 5 years old, living in Duarte, California. And I remember these days, because, like, I don't know, you start remembering things when you're like 4 or 5. And all I remember is that I remember the Night Stalker being all over the news, because, just so people know, like, the Night Stalker was hitting Monrovia, Sierra Madre, Arcadia. These are all all surrounding areas to Duarte. If you look at the map, they're like all around Duarte. So it was like, I remember my mom telling me as a 5-year-old, we had to always remember to lock the doors, because the Night Stalker was famous for sneaking into people's houses who had unlocked doors or open windows. So it was 100% like, lock the doors, lock the windows. And my mom would have us keep our outdoor lights on even overnight, so that he wouldn't like think he could get in without light. I mean, this was a very real fear.
That's not crazy. We leave ours on all night.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Well, how's your electric bill?
Huge bill.
I mean, I was thinking about when we were watching the documentary before, and we were talking about how, if that were happening today, and what a unique experience that is now to have lived in a city where there was an active serial killer, like, on the loose right now. Like, he's on the loose right now around you. So lock your door.
Well, and right? One thing I'll say, not to take away any, not to make this really serious, but one thing my parents didn't tell me at the time, because I was too young to understand, and I didn't know until I watched this documentary, was that the Night Stalker wasn't only, you know, raping and murdering people, he was also sexually abusing kids that were 5 and 6 years old.
I didn't know any of that.
I didn't know about that, because he wasn't tried for that. So I'm sure my parents aren't telling me, but they must have been scared. You know, I have a 5-year-old, and my sister was 8 and a half. We're like the prime age of kids he was abducting and sexually abusing. So it's really scary when I think about it. I don't remember understanding enough other than I knew it was a serial killer. I knew we had to keep our doors locked. And I remember when he was caught and my parents were just so, especially my mom was so relieved. That's all I remember.
They decided, I think this was in the third episode, they decided to keep all that stuff out so the kids wouldn't have to go to trial, right?
Yeah. And also they had enough counts on him, I guess, that they could prosecute him. But it is really scary when I think back because like he really was hitting all over the areas near us. And that was my experience with the Night Stalker.
Yeah. And if you don't live in Los Angeles or if you've never been here, you might not really know how it is. But to me, Los Angeles is LA County. And it's like a city attached to a bunch of other cities and towns. And it just never ends. So for him to pop up in all these different areas, you just never know. You just never knew if it would be your neighborhood or not. And they're all connected. So it easily could be your neighborhood because he goes from one to one. And it looked like it started out on the east side and then it goes over to Glendale, which I actually used to live in Glendale. So it's really when you're watching it and living in LA and kind of knowing all of those places and knowing how they're all connected, it makes it so much more eerie. And
yeah,
to know that he really had an advantage because it's like a jungle here. Could just go, you just hop a bus or grab a bike or something and you're in a different part of the city and it's a whole different world.
It was definitely creepy. I also remember as a kid remembering that because it was right around the time I found out about when he killed like the really old women. So for some reason, my first memories was that he was only killing elderly people and only killing people whose doors were unlocked. Again, this was in the minds of a 5-year-old.
No, right.
And that's all that I could encompass. But that's what I remember living in Duarte. And funny enough, most people know me know like when I was 6, our family moved to Rancho Cucamonga, which everyone knows me from because that's where I spent most of my adolescence. But before we moved to Rancho, we lived in Duarte, which was right in this area. Real quick, just to get or to get into the actual documentary to talk about, the only thing I want to say to kind of set it up for people who haven't seen it or people who are thinking of seeing it is that, you know, any documentary has to take some sort of approach or an angle. And this documentary, it basically takes it's kind of through the lens of two Los Angeles County Sheriff detectives. It's Gil Carrillo. I'm probably mispronouncing, of course. Carrillo. You like that with the R's? I can roll my R's.
That's interesting.
And Frank Salerno. Carrillo was the more junior cop. Salerno, funny enough, was a detective who was involved in finding the Hillside or solving the Hillside Strangler murders. So that's the only research I did. Sorry, everyone. But I just wanted to say that because the entire documentary is kind of 4 hours and the story is told through the perspectives of these two LA detectives who hunted him down. Actually, I'm interested, Jacob, did you like that kind of perspective, taking it from their perspective? Did you think that was different?
At first, I didn't think I was going to like it. I was kind of, I want to hear it more from the victims, I guess, first. Or I didn't think I was going to enjoy it because I thought it was going to be this just cop story that I couldn't relate to. But it actually ended up being really relatable. And I really bought into the story. And they brought the victims along, and survivors, I want to say, really. They brought them along to speak and to participate as well. And I actually really like the cop angle because you start to really care about, both of them. And I especially felt for Carrillo. He was the younger one. And I just really bought into his story with his family and his wife leaving him for a time because she was afraid to be in the city and probably afraid of what it was doing to their relationship. There was just a lot of heart in it. So it really appealed to me in that way.
No, these cops, or I was going to say these cops, it was like 24/7. Their life was dedicated to these murders.
And like the fact that the wife had to leave and take the children, I don't blame her.
Well, I mean, she was like, because they lived in LA too. So she's like, you know, the murders and the crimes were so
random.
There was no method to the madness. It was women. It was men. It was kids. It was elderly. It was every city or every part of LA. So they lived in LA and she was just like, which I would have done too. I mean, I'm sure my parents, obviously we didn't have anywhere we could go. So it was just like, but people in LA were collectively scared.
I mean, I don't think I would have slept. I lived in Ohio, but We slept with our windows open. I don't remember locking the door.
Tim's family would have been the first. No. I think it's definitely a product of your town and where you grew up. I mean, obviously, if you guys were in LA during the Night Stalker, no. Hopefully Ohio. You would have made.
But then you were talking about everyone being afraid in LA, but then it started to happen in San Francisco. So then it grows. Well, no, that's the thing. They started to that. Well, they alluded to the fact that they really felt that there were more murders than the initial when he had already been arrested. There was a moment in the documentary where he said something where he was laughing and kind of being maniacal about. He was kind of taunting the police about, hey, remember this one killing in the Bay Area? I did it, you know. And that was really just
disturbing.
It is really disturbing. And to go kind of in order of the episodes, because obviously, like Tim said, it did feel like one really long movie. But I remember the first episode of the documentary, it really kind of sets the scene, meaning like it doesn't just dive right into it. It's like you learn about the cops more. Like, did you guys notice it felt like it really the first episode, especially?
Yeah,
because like
he was like
cops.
A rookie cop and he looked up to the guy that. Who became his partner?
Salerno, the one who had solved the Hillside Strangler. And I actually don't know a lot about the Hillside Strangler. I'm sure you do, Jacob. But Salerno was actually known for so he was involved in a huge serial killer case before, and Gil kind of looked up to him. It's Gil and Frank are the cops. Right. Gil's
but
the young
not
one.
Not only did the other cop, apparently the killer, which is revealed, I think in the third episode.
They discover who it is. I think the police discovered who it was. I think they told maybe the end of the third.
And I guess it was probably about the third episode where they learned who he was, and then they finally nailed him at the end.
Well,
but...
in the first episode, I'm just trying to keep like a logical order for this. But in the first episode, they establish kind of the cops and who they are. And then you hear about like it's the first murder, which was a woman who I guess like her roommate actually survived. And was able to give them like a little bit of a sketch on the first murder. But I think what was horrifying to me is that like she like got away and then she like ran into him again, but she like was shot at and it missed her. And then
it got her
well, it shot it. It reflected off of her keys, which that has got to be the craziest thing to ever happen to a person. Like,
I mean, she well, glad really. She had those keys.
Yeah. I mean, imagine that you're like someone shoots you, they hit you, but they hit your keys. I mean, it's almost like a moment of invincibility. Like, are
you're
you
like, I'm
shoot
carrying
person
these
again?
Keys forever.
And she even remember she even said something to him when she meets him later. She said something like, you already shot me once. Or are you going to shoot me again or just go ahead and shoot me again or something?
I wish they would have interviewed her.
That's the thing. They kept showing a like shot.
Well, they
of
did,
her,
didn't they?
Survivor. No, they kept showing clips of her walking to the courthouse, but they never actually interviewed her. They interviewed throughout the documentary. They do have interviews with a lot of the survivors, but some I'm sure don't want to talk about it. I'm sure it's traumatizing.
And the families, wow.
What struck me about the first murder was that they said in the documentary that literally the woman was hiding under like it was kind of like a cabinet or something, and he was waiting for her to rise up to look to see if he was gone with the gun there, so that right when she rose up he shot her in the head. And that is so horrifying.
It's so premeditated. Yeah. What a sick
I mean he guy. Totally he was really I think speaking to the thrill and motivation that the killer gets from fear, which is kind of something that you see in that behavior sometimes. I don't want to get into that realm of stuff I don't know as much about, but he was tapping into that early on, he was suggesting. And I think that's part of what helped them learn about in the entire way that he operated.
Well, and that's how they kind of in the first episode. So you're hearing about these murders and they do show like different crime scene photos. But I thought what was nice is that they put like black lines through the victim's eyes so you don't see
eyes. Looking at those crime
scene photos,
that was OK. Like, it takes me a lot to be scared when I go to sleep at night. Because it was in with the music that they added and just showing them, and then they'd show like
knowing it's real.
Yeah, knowing that it actually happened. I think that's where I was just like, oh, this is not easy viewing.
Well, it also was a little bit even scarier with the tape over their eyes, or with the black over their eyes. It made it a little bit it kind of more just signified real. That those, it made it more real, and it kind of signified that those people are no longer alive.
And it was scary. I will say this. I right after the documentary came out, I saw on social media there were a lot of reviews like way too gory, too much gore, and we can wait to get to like overall thoughts of the documentary, but just right off the bat, I didn't think it was overly gory in any way.
It's about a killer.
Well, it is about a killer, but it's just like crime scene photos are available on the web, so if people want to see these, they're available. And I guess maybe it's because we're people that watch horror all the time. Like I thought they were. Yes, they showed real things, but I didn't think there was too much gore. Like, did you feel like, Jacob, that there was too much gore in the documentary?
Well, it's triggering to some people, and I understand why. It did not feel as gory as the media made it sound like it was going to be, or people talking about it made it sound like it was going to be. It just didn't. I was really expecting a lot more, and I was expecting to be kind of taken out of it and distracted by it, and that didn't happen at all.
I was totally disturbed.
Again, you know, it's disturbed, but it's like, but here's the thing, they do a bunch of, I would call them like light dramatizations through it, but I don't mean like, you know, 80s unsolved mysteries where they show like the full murders and people. They would have like, they'd show a gun going off or a hammer hitting something and a blood spurt, but you never saw an actual person being like, they never dramatized the actual crime. It was just like little references to it. And I don't know, I guess I just thought that was a creative way to disturb people without going too far. You know what I mean? Like, I guess I'm saying that I actually liked that. I'm not saying I like disturbing shit. It's just, I like that they didn't show a hammer going into a person's head. They showed a hammer hitting something that you don't see and blood coming out. Like, it was a very, I don't know, to me it seemed a little bit more of a tasteful dramatization, if that even makes sense.
I mean, like, if you watch Unsolved Mysteries, you know, they tried to recreate it, which is almost worse.
But I mean, they did, but at least they didn't overdo it. And so that's why, again, like you said, Jacob, I was expecting it was going to be like full on, like dramatizing, watching, seeing the full murders and be really gory. Yeah. So I was like, that's what people were complaining about. I was pretty surprised.
I think if you're a true crime fan or you just like these kinds of documentaries or whatever, I think it was really satisfying in that way, because it didn't bum me out the same way. They didn't use too much of the serial killer's words. That's one thing that you'll find in a lot of these documentaries and things, is that it'll be like interviews with the killer, and they'll be playing audio tape of that, of, you know, Ted Bundy or somebody. And that works for some people, but it kind of bums me out a little bit. And so they only had a little bit of audio for Richard Ramirez throughout.
Yeah, the very last 10 minutes.
Well, and they had a little bit in different parts, but having just a little bit kind of gave you enough of a window into him, but not, it didn't like overwhelm you with it, because I didn't want it to be like that. I didn't want to be in the mind of the killer in this documentary. I wanted to see him get caught. And, you know, eventually
in the mouth of madness, Tim.
I mean, I'm glad that you told me, because I went into this completely blind, and Matt, you said, oh, the ending's really satisfying. What happens to him?
Or like how he got caught.
How he got caught.
I love that your ending, like a movie.
Ending,
like,
no, I know. But I mean, the ending
is there a sequel?
The ending of the four episodes. Like, I was like, I was glad to see that
he got caught. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, cause you watch the two policemen struggle to get the clues. And then we'd even talk about how the media completely like,
let's keep moving on then to the second and even the third episode. That's when they really go into each murder. Like, and what I like that they do is that they talk about like how many days from the first murder it was. And they go in, like, it was like from spring through summer of 1985. And literally there's a time during, I'd say, the months of like March, May, July, like where there were multiple murders or rapes or crimes all within like those months. And they go through each one and they give you info on it. And some of them had a, you know, what I think is the scariest is obviously the people that are being murdered, but when one person survives and one doesn't, and I noticed, I don't know if you guys noticed, but whenever there was like a husband and wife attacked and one survived, none of those people were in this documentary.
Oh, gosh.
Meaning like, I don't think they could ever talk about this. Never. The people that were in the documentary were relatives of people died. And I think one that was really effective for me was the girl who lost her grandmother. And I only remember the name because I'm looking, her grandmother's name was Joyce Nelson, and they had the granddaughter and the daughter, and they were just talking about how, like, they literally knew, you know, they had heard about, by this time it was in the middle of the killing spree, so they had heard about the Night Stalker, and she was trying to get, like, her grandma to be a little bit, you know, more protective, like, lock your door, and she's like, no, I'm gonna live my life the way I did. And then she gets murdered and the daughter found her, and that is just so unbelievably heartbreaking.
It's really incredibly sad. And Tim, you were talking about how living in the Midwest, like, your family wouldn't lock your doors, and I can easily see some of my
family doing
that.
We had our windows wide open.
I was just going to say, I also noticed, I really think that it has to do with people think it's not going to happen to me. Everyone thinks that. It's like, yes, that's just someone you hear about in the news, but it's not going to happen to me. And that's what I think this killer was preying upon. Like, there were a lot of people that were stuck in their ways, and it's totally fine because you have to live the way you want to live. You should never let, like, someone else determine how you live. But this killer was taking advantage of people's trust in, like, society and their neighborhoods and everything. And it's just so awful because, you know, a lot of the victims were defenseless, like elderly people or kids, or it was just all over the spectrum.
It was like, you know how, not that I'm comparing any of this to a movie, but in the movie Jaws, it's a shark and a shark will eat anyone. You know what I'm saying?
Like, this guy was
he's like a shark in the sense that anyone in his path that could possibly die.
So I feel like we should get back to one thing you brought up, Tim. And as they were going through the investigation, I'd say in episodes 2 and 3 of this, probably 3, they start to find some clues, one of which is a footprint that's literally the same shoe at almost every crime scene. And for cops, that's amazing because they were finding it was like an Avia shoe that tied all these murders together. So they at least knew it's the same person that's committing these murders. Well, there were a couple of problems. Number one, there was like the big blunder of when at the time Mayor Dianne Feinstein, who was mayor of San Francisco, went on, you know, like a press conference and basically said, we're looking for someone who has these shoes. And right away he like changed shoes and they're like, well, great. There goes that. But one thing that stuck out to me other than that, that was just such a like, oh, why did they do this? So in about episode 2, 3, you find out in a stolen car that he had stolen, he had a business card that had a dental office on it. And they went to the dental office and they found...
tried to put up a camera and catch him. But then remember, it didn't film. It didn't. Is that right?
No. What happened was they talked to the dentist, and the dentist, they were enough to give him enough of a description that he was like, yes, I remember that patient. He had an impacted tooth. He's probably going to be coming back. But he had given a fake name. So they send police officers there to wait at the dental office like daily for him to come back. They set up cameras. And literally, I think it was the day before he ended up coming back, they pulled police officers from the scene and like gave up, figuring they weren't going to find him. And then they got a call the next day, oh, he came in the office today, aka they could have caught him that day. And this is before maybe 5 or 6 of his last murders. And that, not only does that just kill me inside, but it almost makes me really, really angry because it's like, oh my God, just kept cops there for one more day, literally they could have caught him and that would have saved all the people after that. I mean, I know there's a million what ifs, and I'm not saying these cops did a great job and everything, but there were some blunders that even police admit that could have solved this and stopped this case before.
Yeah, there are so many moments that if they'd just been a little bit different, then maybe so many people wouldn't have died. But that's actually part of a disturbing part of the documentary. It was kind of interesting because of the insight it gave into the police. But when they talked about how, in a way, they needed more people to be victims because that would give them more clues.
Right. That was a very interesting line. Like he said, like he was the cop was torn because he wanted more clues, but the only way to get more clues is if people got attacked.
And that's the thing. And they, like, it was also, I don't know how, and you could tell Gil, the younger cop, because both Gil and Frank are the main, like, driving the narrative of this documentary. And you can tell that it affected their lives, especially Gil. Like, I mean, there's parts when he gets emotional and stuff, especially when he had to talk to kids who were abducted, because the kids, for some reason, and I don't know why, I'm not even going to venture to guess, but he never murdered the children. He sexually assaulted them. but he never murdered the children. He murdered the adults. And so they were able to talk to kids, and he had to interview some of these kids. And he said it was just like heartbreaking for him. But these cases, like, I can't even imagine being a detective on a case like this and it like consuming your life.
Yeah, I mean, there's no way you can just be like, oh, it's 5 o'clock, I'm clocking
yeah,
out.
It's like, yeah, I'm not taking work home with me. I mean, like, this guy, like I, like you had said, his wife left.
And he had, like, and there was a point where he was only getting, like, an hour of sleep, if that.
You always see that kind of, that character in detective shows and everything, constantly working on the job, trying to find out who the killer is, and, you know, their relationship is fragmented because of it. And it kind of seems like it's just a... something that happens in stories, but it's real. Like, that's real life. These historic cases where these serial killers, like the Golden State Killer or this one that we're talking about, the Night Stalker, it takes real sacrifice from the people who were working on catching them, especially at the time when it was harder to catch killers. We didn't have the same advantages with DNA and technology that we have. And I don't know, obviously, I don't know what it's like to be a cop or what really goes into the job, but it's a real thing that you're really putting your life on the line and you're putting your entire life into it.
And these are, I mean, they were both detectives, you know, making sure there's the difference between, because it's like, you know, these, guys, you know, there's obviously, I don't know all the specifics of what's the difference, a cop, detective, but I mean, detectives, literally, you're assigned a case and you're on it until you solve it. And when it's a huge thing, like,
right, you work up to detective, it's something you work up to, but even just if you want to be a detective, you're still putting your whole life into being a police officer so that you can eventually become a detective.
Yeah.
Both of the main detectives in the series had clearly, one of them was senior and had dedicated his entire life to it. And the other was kind of a rising star. He was very young and moving up in the ranks quickly because of his dedication.
And then there was also the San Francisco.
Yeah, cop. I was just going to bring him up. You know what I think is funny? So when we get to like the last episode, and this is like, it's almost like it made me a little upset for the two cops. So again, this whole narrative is being driven by the two LA detectives. I'd say 85 to 90% of the crimes that from the Night Stalker took place in LA County versus like a few that were in San Francisco. But of course, it happened to be the San Francisco detective who finally got the name of it. And didn't you almost feel like, I feel like if you were one of the LA detectives at that point, of course, all you want to do is solve this. But it's like, I've worked so hard. And then this guy who's on it for like a minute. And so, did either of you think that?
No, I mean, you just have to be happy that it's getting solved.
Of course. But I just was like, really? It's like, imagine it's like you're on a group project. It's like you, Jacob, and I are on a group project. And Jacob and I are like working for a solution all day. And then Tim comes in 5 minutes like, how about that? And
that sounds like it would most accurately happen.
Of course, 100%. But did you notice that? Like, am I the only one who noticed when we watched? No, it's like the LA cops did all the work, and then the San Francisco guy came in, swooped in, and got the name.
I don't think he's
right.
He did it. I mean, look, remember, they had found a friend of the Night Stalker.
No, they got a clue, and the guy said like he was bragging about killing two people.
Yeah. So they
interviewed. So he said, tell me. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
I will say now, the San Francisco cop, that was one point where I was like, with the way the San Francisco detective was talking about the way
he was a little Superman-ish.
He took the friend in custody and basically like punched him and threatened him again and said, give me his name. And then finally the guy's like, Richard Ramirez. And it's like he was bragging about literally committing police brutality. But hey.
Yeah. No.
Well, okay. That's true. I mean, and look, when you're the only one there to tell your story, like you're gonna tell your story in a way that really makes you look probably tougher than you were. But yeah, it was kind of funny and kind of like the documentary almost like took a turn for a minute. It's like, why
it
are
did
we
I mean again don't
talk
wanna,
about
don't
this?
Don't want to make this political. I wonder if they filmed this before like all of the police protests of 2020. But it's just funny because I think that I'm just assuming the San Francisco detective was so happy that he got the name that he was like, who cares that I broke all the rules?
I don't agree in police brutality. But I mean, what I'm saying is that, you know, the guy, people's lives are at stake.
No, of course. Right.
So I mean, like
a name.
Punch in the face, you know.
Yeah, it was so just the way he was bragging about, like, you know, he was like this big,
I would brag about it too.
Right. I think he was kind of glorifying it. If he had been more like just saying, you know, I did what I had to do.
No, I 100% agree. Look, just was a funny way that they had it. Of course, they should. Remember, I'm still back at the effing dentist's office. I still am so pissed that they didn't. Really, because I remember watching and I was like, are you kidding me? The day before he showed up imagine if the cops would stay there one more day, they would have, like, the dentist would have said as soon as he came in, this the guy, they would have taken him into custody. And then probably can't what if it, but it just, when you're talking about lives are at stake, I just wish those decisions had been made. But anyway, moving to how he got arrested, which I think is such a cool, like, almost like community.
It's the best part of the whole story to me.
And so I think for people who don't know much about the Night Stalker, like Tim didn't before he started watching, at least know that there is a, I don't want to say happy ending, but satisfying, because when they finally got his name, they were able to like locate, he had a mugshot, and because he had had prior arrests. And so they blasted his mugshot, which I'm glad they did, and name all over the news, the newspapers, everything. They were in stores. So finally, when he had been like on a trip visiting family in Arizona, when Richard Ramirez came back to LA
on a bus.
Yes. So after he escapes, like the bus station, he's like running, and people start in the neighborhood start recognizing him, and they're like, that's the killer, and literally start chasing him. And basically, like, vigilante justice, jump on him, beat him down, and hold him down, and call the cops and wait for the cops to come pick him up.
He tries to steal a guy's car, and the guy pops him one, right?
What did that? That may have happened. Yeah. I just remember. I mean, it's like it was funny. And yeah, what did you think of that, Jacob? Like, of all the guys, the people coming after him and stuff. It's like,
I mean, it was the best part of the story. It's to me the most unifying part of the whole case, because you're getting the entire community to just all gang up on this person, and they're not letting him go, and they're not like beating on him and stuff. They're gonna wait until the police get there, but they are holding him there. And it's just one of those things that, like, it's heartwarming to know that if there were a killer in your town or in your neighborhood, that, hey, your whole neighborhood's going to come together when the time is right and stop it. And he was, like, going from place to place, and more people were like, oh, my God, that's the guy. We got to follow him.
I loved it. I loved it, too.
That's so cool.
I loved it because it was, like, it felt like it's like a community standing together. You know what I mean? It's almost like, I feel like it's something like, whether
like
you
the
have
Salem witch trials. Oh
God, no, not at all. Yeah, no, it's like, if you have like, it's like, say you have differences with neighbors or people like that, it's literally like everyone in that community put any difference they must have had aside, because they all knew they had the same enemy, this person who is killing people all throughout their neighborhood. And so I absolutely loved it. And the cops like pick him up, and didn't he spit on the window like as they were driving away? I think, like, the, you know, Richard Mercy,
I'm sure he did,
really.
I mean,
classy,
he was a big creep,
classy guy, but like just totally like spit on the window. But they captured him. You know, then in the last episode of the documentary, they do briefly go through the trial, because I think they didn't want to focus
on, and by
on
the
him.
Way that trial went from 85 to 89.
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, that's how to feel like trials take forever.
I mean, there were a lot of victims and a lot of different cases within the whole thing. So,
and it was interesting, something, Tim, you brought up. They didn't even charge him with any of the child abductions. Number one, because they didn't want to have to bring the children on the stand. Number two, they had so much to charge him with, and they were going for the death penalty. They like had overwhelming evidence and charges that they didn't even need it. Like, it's almost... part of me was like, but wait, I wanted him to be accountable for everything, but I also understand, obviously, not to bring the children in, like, and they can still try him. And I think what was really disturbing, like I said, they didn't focus on the trial, which they could have, and they didn't, and, you know, we didn't really need it, but...
We had a little bit, like, just the it became very theatrical, because he became, like, addicted to fame.
Yes, they show him wearing sunglasses, thinking he's Mr. Cool. He had groupies, women that were sending him, like, nude pictures.
In jail, gross.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you see that in other cases, too, especially around that time with Ted Bundy. He had a lot of fans, and I don't know if Richard Ramirez himself was like you said, addicted to the fame so much as maybe he was latching onto it when he's going through a murder trial, but he definitely reciprocated it. You know, he fed into it. I remember when we were laughing over a comment that one of the people made about the women.
The woman that's in the new, I forget who. Oh no, that was the woman who I remember this. He like drove by and smiled, and she recognized him like right at the beginning of the murder spree. But they interview her, and they just like throw in a quote. She's like, "I think if those girls are sending him pictures, they're a bunch of dumb bitches."
Desperate? Like, was it like, desperate dumb bitches?
Something like that. But I was like,
I think she said the dumbest she'd ever known,
or the dumbest bitches ever, or something like that.
It's crazy to me because we're also I don't know, have we spoken about this yet? He's also was like a Satan worshiper.
Yeah, we haven't touched on it, but I will say one of the things, I mean, this guy had a lot of nerve and a lot of balls, I guess. If he had a tattoo of a pentagram on his hand, and he literally flashed it at the jury at the beginning of their trial, and I'm like,
he said, "Hail Satan."
What are you trying to prove? Oh, that's going to help. I mean, I guess at this point he didn't care, or he was just like laughing in their faces.
I think
I mean, there's a lot about his life and about who he really was that I still haven't gotten that deep into. I was actually thinking, though, about our friend Kevin Cook with the Jury Room podcast, whose promo that we played at the beginning of this episode. He just did an episode on the Night Stalker and actually went into a lot of detail about Richard Ramirez and who he was leading up to these murders. And there's a lot of demonic ritualism and different things behind him and his entire makeup and pathology.
And here's the thing, like, as I said at the beginning and I've echoed a lot of times, obviously, like, this isn't going to be the podcast you listen to learn about Richard Ramirez, like, but there are millions of resources, podcasts, like the one that you mentioned, The Jury Room, and also other, you know, just documentaries, other things on it. But strictly from, like, our perspective of just kind of, you know, entertainment purposes, and also, you know, and educational purposes overall.
100% in education. Well,
yeah, but overall, did you, and I know it's hard to say this with something so dark, but did you enjoy this? I would love to know, did you guys enjoy the documentary?
I would.
Absolutely.
Jacob, you go first.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm glad that you asked that, because you're supposed to enjoy it. It is entertainment. That's why it's on Netflix. And I think with true crime especially, there are a lot of people who are really kind of ambivalent about the entertainment aspect of it, but it is entertainment, and you can have mutual feelings. Like, you can feel for the victims, and you can feel for the people involved in these crimes, and you can care about justice, and you can be sensitive to all of that and still also be really fascinated by it and be interested in it, and also think that it's very entertaining and enjoyable. I'm going to use all the positive words that you associate with entertainment, because it is entertainment.
Thrilling.
It's thrilling. It was lovely. It was fulfilling. But yeah, I really did enjoy it. I appreciated it. I thought it gave a really clear picture over the case and Richard Ramirez, and just, it really painted a picture of the fear that it caused in Los Angeles and in the Bay Area in California at that time. And I thought it was really well done. Yeah.
How about you, Tim? Tim?
My takeaway from watching it was 1985 looked like the 70s. we've come a long way from 1985. You know, just because I feel like with cameras everywhere and the way we do fingerprints.
Yeah.
You know, I found it very sad. I'm sure the killer's life was terrible. He made many people's lives terrible. Like, it was just, I don't recommend watching it by yourself. I don't recommend watching it at night before you go to bed.
When you're stalking.
Right. Someone. Like, I left me with I felt like I needed to take a shower afterwards.
I see what you're saying.
It would be my first choice to watch, but I am glad that I watched it, and I'm glad that I was educated on my history of Los Angeles.
Well, I'm going to now take aspects of both of what you said, because I kind of agree with both assessments, and this is how I feel. When watching it, again, I did know, I probably knew more about the Night Stalker than either you fuckers, only because I had lived through that. Because again, it's like, if a killer
is... that, you were fine.
No, but I mean, if a killer is known for where you
through it.
No, but I'm not trying to make a dramatic, like, oh god, I was one of the, I'm just saying, if a killer is in your town at any time of your life, you're going to remember that killer.
True,
so
true.
Of all serial killers, that's the one I always remember. With that said, there's a lot I didn't know. I I do recommend it because I did find it both educational and entertaining. And even though it is dark, remember, we're a horror podcast. There's some very dark themes in some of the movies we watch. But I thought it was entertaining in terms of it told a story. You know, it went from victim to victim. It's almost like a mini series where you're acquiring a little bit of evidence here, a little bit of evidence. You're getting closer. And then you get that satisfying conclusion of finding the killer, identifying the killer, and then putting that fucker away, you know. So I did think it was it definitely is.
It made
disturbing.
Me never want to be a cop.
It's definitely dark. It tells about, you know, from the detective's point of view, and you see how, you know, year for how intense it was. And you know, but I also, yeah, I thought it was, again, I thought the gore, however you'd say it, was, and I say tastefully done. I know we're dealing with real people. I just mean that I don't think it was too exploitative. They showed crime photos, but I didn't think it was like they overdid it. So I thought for what it was good. There's a ton more information on the Night Stalker, like you said. So you're not going to get every bit of knowledge you need. But for like a first timer, I thought it was an interesting, you know, entertaining documentary.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I might be a last timer. I felt like I got enough.
You got enough of the Night Stalker. Yeah. You didn't like that shot of him just staring.
No,
with that,
and you know,
awful...
they did. We didn't talk about his eyes. He did.
You
have...
mean the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes?
Yeah, he really did have the devil's eyes. Truth be told, I woke up after we watched it, and I like at 4 a.m. because I was like, "What was that noise?"
Well, I mean, the only reason I'm saying this is because horror movies do that too?
No,
do you know what I mean? It's like
they're fake.
Well, yeah. Okay. I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm looking from the perspective of someone who loves horror movies and loves that kind of thrill of stuff may actually enjoy. You know what I mean? I'm looking from entertainment. He's a killer. He could be Michael Myers.
No,
he could be Jason Voorhees.
It's just so different.
Because it's real. I know.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, you mean Michael Myers isn't real? Wait.
Right.
What?
Exactly.
Well, look, I want to thank you, Jacob, for coming on the podcast. This was the perfect thing to talk about
with
you.
Always good to see your beautiful face.
Beautiful, beautiful face.
Thank you for having me. It was great to see you guys and your beautiful faces and letting me talk a little bit about this really crazy, good, and definitely horrific documentary.
Yes, and also we just want to tell all of our listeners, please tune in to the podcast Crime of Your Life, which is hosted by Jacob. It is so well done, and I don't have enough good things to say about it, but he really puts a lot of time into researching the stories and telling a great story. It's very engaging, and people who like true crime are going to like this, and they're interesting unsolved mysteries and different things, and there's a lot to come with that. So please stay tuned for Crime of Your Life.
Where can people find you on the socials? Are you on the Twitter or on the Instagram?
I'm on all of the socials, at Crime of Your Life, everywhere, at Crime of Your Life, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and
I
am. Yeah, okay. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Yes, thank you.
See you on
I'm
MySpace.
Saying thank you. I mean, I'm going to be editing the hell out of this.
I know. I just want to leave our listeners with, please lock your doors and your windows, no matter where you live.
That's a horrible thing to leave people
with. I think it's important to be safe, you know? Lock your doors and your windows. Wait, why do I feel like... Isn't that the beginning? Lock your doors. Bolt your windows. That's from The Thing, which starts... In Halloween, I have to bring everything back to Halloween. I'm sorry. I always do because Halloween's the greatest movie of all time. That's it, everyone. Thank you for watching. No.
Thank you, everyone. I'm only here with Jacob. That's not it.
No, I know. It's just anyway. No, thank you, everybody, for listening to Happy Horror Time.
Yeah, thank you for listening to Happy Horror Time.
We'll talk to you
guys.
Soon.
Bye,
okay,
Jacob.
Bye. Bye, Jacob.
Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Happy Horror Time. We're so happy you've taken the time to check out our podcast.
This podcast is hosted by Tim Murdoch and myself, Matt Emmert. It's co-produced by Jacob Randall.
You can find Happy Horror Time on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, Happy TV, and many other streaming platforms.
If you'd like to stay updated on our developments, please like and follow the Happy Horror Time podcast page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Happy Horror Time.
And if you'd like to contact us, send an email to happyhorrortime@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts, your movie recommendations, and any horror celebrities you'd like us to interview.
To support the podcast, please visit patreon.com/happyhorrortime and sign up to be a patron. That'll give you access to our growing library of bonus episodes. Our goal is to release at least one bonus episode per month.
I'm Tim Murdoch.
And I'm Matt Amert.
And thanks again for listening to
Happy Horror Time.